gave me a bolt cutter. We love to break it. We claim all the space. Welcome to the Ownership Economy Podcast, the podcast that explores the people and ideas that are utilizing technology, economics, and the law to reimagine how the economy can work for everyone. In this week's episode, we speak to Tim Rand, Managing Partner at Mercy Course Ventures. In this conversation, we cover his background in development economics, ranging in places from Afghanistan, Cambodia, and other places in the Global South, the experiences that he learned from in those situations and places, and what he's bringing into the impact investment arm of the global nonprofit Mercy Corps. We also dive into how Mercy Corps is thinking about impact, how impact is measured in the portfolio, and how Web3 tools are beginning to figure in a lot of ways for their entrepreneurs and the companies that they're looking at. We hope you enjoyed the episode, and if you like, please rate and subscribe and like us on your preferred podcast app. Thank you. Tim, cool. Thanks a lot for joining us today, man.
Yeah, super excited to be here. Thanks for making the time.
Yeah, I think like we've run into each other in so many places. We've had a lot of real life conversations. So it's actually kind of weird for me to talk to you behind a screen.
Yeah, ditto.
Yeah, but you know, like I said, thanks for joining, man. I think the way we like to start this too is first in the audience, you know, a couple things. One, sorry, I'm sick, so you'll hopefully not hear me cough. I'll try to avoid doing that. And then second is, I do believe, Tim, we'll get to this whenever we get to it, but we've either done diligence on deals together, we may have co-invested in things where it is, you know, natural or obvious. I'll just call it out just so people are like, oh, okay, that's the thing they've both done. And they're not just trying to shill. They're not trying to shill their wares at us when it comes up. So just a couple of disclosures on that front. And then, yeah, other than that, you know, we start this off by having you tell us a bit about yourself. You know, from our conversations, you have a widely varied background. You've worked in development finance. You've worked in social entrepreneurship and developing economies. And now you're doing the VC thing and impact investing in Mercy Corps. So where does your story start?
Yeah, well, it depends how far back you want to go. But usually where I started is, yeah, I grew up in Chicago. My dad was a police officer by day, but I had a bunch of side hustles at night. And so grew into family business of selling rock and roll memorabilia, mostly vinyl records from an early age. And the reason I mention that is because, yeah, I mean, from being, you know, kind of co-opted, forced, if you will, into kind of a family business and just like, you know, going around to garage sales, buying, going to like Beetle Fest around the US, just like kind of learning from an early age,
awesome.
Like trading, rock and roll, how to like customer service, like relationships fundamentally. I think that like really set the tone of, you know, what I want to do when I hit that inflection point, you know, in college where everybody has like, not everybody, but, you know, at least I had that awakening of like, am I really going to go work at Deloitte and like, you know, do accounting, which was my degree, or am I going to do something else? And I reflected on like, yeah, what totally. I learned from my dad, which was just like the reason, you know, he didn't make a ton of money from, or he didn't really make meaningful money from his rock and roll business. But the reason he did it is because he loved just delighting people, giving them that piece of nostalgia, helping them find that thing they didn't even know existed. It was the relationships behind it that bound him to the other traders and sellers, customers, and just the community around it. And so, yeah, I think that was a piece of it. And then, you know, as I came to be in like that intoxicating period in the late 90s, early 2000s of like, Easterly versus Sachs and like international development and like the searchers versus the planners and then social entrepreneurship and Grameen Bank, like it was kind of wrapped up in that, right? And I said, well, yeah, you know, like forget the big four at that point. I think there was still four, but forget the big four and like, yeah, I want to try something else. So I was fortunate enough in college to meet a woman who'd be my good friend and mentor, who was setting up ecotourism business and social enterprise in Cambodia. And she, you know, I helped her out on her business plan and stuff. And then she said, hey, why don't you come out to Cambodia? Help me Whoa. Launch this thing and grow it. And yeah, I got a one-way flight out to Cambodia, thought I'd be there and maybe go back to Deloitte or something. And instead ended up, I guess, living abroad the last, I don't know, 15, 18 years. I can't even count anymore. And so jumping from that startup to working in microfinance with Kiva, starting a few different MFIs, Just jumping around at different
Oh,
different operating.
and one thing, when we the our audience is pretty diverse, but a lot of it is, 50% crypto. Some of it, we have a lot of development finance people here, but when you drop MFI, also, if you can explain what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So microfinance institutions. So my kind of my one of my big interests when I was getting into this space was the concept of microfinance, small loans, either to individuals or like in groups where they're kind of secured by the group. And to what degree can that money that's largely without restrictions, without kind of priorities, it's there's an interest rate, of course, and repayments and maybe a group dynamic to repaying that. But largely, like, here's the money. You have to make an economic rationale why you're going to use that money, but go grow your business, whether it's a small coconut shop or your farm or whatever it is. And so I was really intensely interested in that. And hence, when I went out to Cambodia, was working with Kiva, a few different microfinance institutions that were kind of larger scale banks that were serving a segment of, again, farmers, households, small businesses that typically just had no access to financing. And so learned a lot of like the ins and outs, the pros and cons, the positive, the negative impacts of that, especially as that industry was just soaring, right? Back from like 2000 to 2010 with all the positive and negatives. So worked in that and helped to launch a company called First Finance with some of the early investors in that, which was one of the first microfinance institutions designed for home lending. Back then, we take it for granted in a lot of developed countries, but back then in Cambodia, in order for somebody to buy a house, you would have had to put down around a 60% down payment and pay something about 30 or 35% interest per year, which meant that buying a home, which is like, or a piece of land, which is the greatest asset most people have for wealth pretty much anywhere in the world, was just totally blocked out most of the market. And so I was excited to be kind of on the ground floor of that, which has grown really tremendously and done well and created a lot of impact. Yeah, and since then, eventually after, founder operator side, ended up jumping over to venture capital and working in a number of ESG funds and impact funds until I got here to Merskore Ventures.
Very cool, man. I'd like to go backwards a little bit. You ended at Mercy. We'll come back to it. But you've done business in Cambodia, Afghanistan, a bunch of other locales. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about, in Web3 and ReFi and all these other movements, some people come to us from places like Kenya, like Iran, Afghanistan. Iran's more or less developed, but just kind of coming from places that you would call the more or less developed world or what have you. And the folks who come from those places deeply understand some of the problems. And the folks who would like to do good things, if they've been there and they've engaged in sort of the right way and not kind of, jumping in and doing the white savior thing or what have you, they understand some of the dynamics. But you're a person who worked alongside these folks for 10 to 12 years building businesses, encountering the problems that in some ways you might not encounter elsewhere. Tell us a little bit about, maybe you can pick a story from that time and tell us a little bit, what is it like, starting a business in Afghanistan or Cambodia, like from the ground up?
It's like, well, I don't have any I don't have any comparable, right? I haven't started a business in the US or Europe, so I can only surmise. But one thing I like to say, and I'm stealing this from one of my I don't have a favorite entrepreneur, they're all my favorite, but one of my favorites in our portfolio, Matt Alexander, who set up one of the hardest businesses in the world, which is land formalization in Colombia. So if you want to start a business and, in a hard sector, try land formalization in Colombia. But he said, like, and he did some work in the valley ahead of time. He said, and in developed markets, you have unlimited talents, you have unlimited capital for the most part. You have clear rules and regulations and kind of a level playing field, if you will, in theory. And none of those things exist in most emerging markets, right? And we could give a lot of different examples, but yeah, generally talent. There's absolutely talent, but it's more scarce. It's typically kind of expensive, hard to find. There's a lot more competition for it. Capital, especially back in like the 2000s, was very scarce. Quantitative easing opened that up, but anyway, you just have every barrier. And then most of the businesses we're trying to create are entirely new sectors that haven't been dreamt up before, or they're kind of going against the norm. So yeah, I mean, I think, gosh, where could I start? One maybe very tangible business that's could be or may not be as exciting for kind of the crypto Web3 crowd, but I think is like very indicative, is a company that was spinning out of a venture builder I was running, called Hydrologic, and they had been one of the first producers of water filters in Cambodia, the largest. I think they had maybe sold over 100,000, 200,000 water filters and population of, I think, 8 or 9 million at that time in Cambodia. And it was a really interesting, everybody recognizes the value of clean water, and there's lots of pathways to get it. When we were launching that business and trying to, you know, convert it from a company that has some subsidized like income streams from donors and other things to like a product company, I think the orientation really had to change of like lots of different factors. One, how do we finance it? Because the water filter to manufacture it in Cambodia is kind of expensive. There's different ways we get around that, but generally speaking, we need to finance it to the end user because they just can't afford it. Even though the cost of boiling water and all these things is theoretically higher, it's a cash flow issue. And so how do you finance it? Who will? How is that affordable? That gets into microfinance potentially, or self-financing, or all these other things, carbon credits eventually. Like, how do you actually distribute it so you don't like have a lot of breakage? What's like the sales network that you want to create? Is it through MFIs? Like, you just have to kind of go one by one and test out these different approaches. But I think the one thing that was most fascinating to me was like, when you think, oftentimes when you're like building business or a product in emerging markets, it's logical to an outsider that, oh, this is something people would want. But the reality of like wants and needs and aspirations is very different on the ground. And the wallet share somebody has is very minimal. And so a lot of where we actually ended up spending a lot of our efforts was kind of on the social marketing side, like really deeply understanding those potential customers and how they perceive clean water, what's their aspiration, and how does that inform the product design? Anyway, like there's a lot of things we ended up tweaking in terms of how the product looks, the name, how it's advertised, to essentially make it an aspirational good, which ultimately drove sales. And that, you know, can sound kind of that can sound kind of wrong in some ways. But again, it's like the approach of like, well, here's something that's good for you, you should just buy it, versus like, here's something and how we actually treat them kind of with dignity and respect. And like, okay, well, this is something that we know, you know, is good, but like, how do we kind of create a pathway where this is something you want to spend your money on and make it as affordable and, you know, high impact as possible?
Well, I thought the really interesting thing is that you have to also grapple with, like you said, the liquidity issue, right? That's basically one of the major things. You're sitting here going like, well, yeah, we found a way to deliver this, you know, where it is, you know, absolutely needed, it's cheaper than the alternatives, but we have to actually go more than one step further. We have to go and say, how can we look at MFIs, DFI, whatever you want to hear, and say, how can you drive that cost even lower? Because people are going to do, and this is not at all exclusive to Cambodians. Like, everyone does this, right? It's like, hey, I'm going to go with the option that's easiest because it's just what's there and it's perceived as cheaper, or I don't have the liquidity to actually, you know, take advantage of the other option because it requires infrastructure that I don't have or something. Right. So it's a thing you don't even think about, and you have to find kind of solve the full value chain of it. You can't even.
We take it just so for granted. I mean, in this, you know, like I mean, the pain of getting a mortgage is real. I mean, there's ways that's being improved in the US or EU and so forth, but like they exist, the government backstops it, you know, that's a clean market. Like everybody here probably gets WhatsApps, emails like 50 times a day for paying in installments and all. I mean, like the financing market is so robust, and the secondary, tertiary, I mean, just like it all is there. And these markets, I mean, we go down a huge rabbit hole, but like, I mean, when we look at like, how do you introduce, let's say, tractors for mechanization of farms to increase productivity, if that's like a goal, let's say, you have to create a secondary market for those tractors to be resold, or if they have to be seized, you have to look at like, what collateral can the farmers put up, or maybe a third party moving collateral for them. I mean, you have to almost recreate that. And the other aspect is like, I just describe that as if it's a total white space, but that's actually not true. And that's what I really personally just deeply love about, especially Afghanistan. I mean, these kind of wild places where like you just think, ah, everything's broken. It's like, no, like these systems really do exist. I mean, it's like, even though there isn't like a formalized kind of secondary market for tractors in Cambodia, or there probably is now, There is definitely a secondary market for tractors. Like, there are people out there, there's small entrepreneurs who are buying these things up, who know which ones are kind of distressed. They'll fix them up. There's a very robust market, especially in Asia, for these things. And that was like, I mean, just another quick anecdote, but I remember when I was in Kabul and I was going between Kartasay and downtown, and I remember getting, we stopped at this little fruit vendor, and I just remember sitting there for like an hour just asking him, like, you know, he had these oranges, where'd these come from? These watermelons, which actually came from Afghanistan, which I never would have predicted. But like the supply chains of all of his things and how it got into a place that back in 2009, 2010, when I was there, you know, seemed complex to get stuff around, but no, stuff gets around. I mean, you know, and it works. And these are perishable goods. They're fragile, and people will find a way. And it might not look how we do it in the West. It might progress that way sometimes, but it works, and it works for them. And it's at the price point people can afford. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think like, this is a good exposition for you know, kind of a backdrop for getting into a little bit of your work at MCV. So, you know, you ran into, you know, you're talking about some things that this new sort of ownership economy you talk about is meant to address, right? There's liquidity issues, there's new ownership primitives, there's going to that enable addressing some of those, maybe through collateral, under collateralized, over collateralized, what have you. You know, and you were up close and personal with some of those issues. You get to see them. And so then at some point, you know, you got all this experience, you ended up getting into impact investing. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you're doing at Mercy Course Ventures and how you got involved with them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll just give the quick spiel on Mercy Corps Ventures. We are a constellation of different fund vehicles. And really what we're trying to do is to accelerate different solutions that are confronting climate change and the lack of financial resilience in emerging markets. So in essence, we are investing in companies as well as partnering with companies to look at how new technologies, models, like paradigms can really make a dent in building climate resilience, financial resilience in these emerging markets for households, individuals, and communities. So practically speaking, we have three vehicles. Our first is our Evergreen Fund. We've done almost 50 investments out of that since we launched it in 2015. Those are equity, SAFs, tokens. We practically invest at pre-seed, seed stage, usually 100K to 300K first check, and then we can follow on. But our modus operandi is that, like, we are essentially a corporate venture capital fund within a larger nonprofit called Mercy Corps. And what we want to do is, number one, leverage Mercy Corps as this $500, $600 million a year nonprofit working in 40 countries around the world. We want to leverage them to make smarter, more impactful investments. But then number two, when we do invest, we want to, you know, as the team ourselves, bring to bear anything possible from this, you know, large multinational organization to support those startups, whether it's helping them in geographic expansion, leveraging community trust we have, piloting in new geographies, whatever it is. Like, we're here to hustle and help you take advantage of that. And then other partnerships that are beyond Mercy Corps, right? Whether it's with local governments, regulators, you know, corporates that are in orbit and what have you. So that's our Evergreen Fund. Again, we've done about 50 investments out of that across like Web 2, Web 3. And again, focus on climate resilience and financial resilience, ag tech, climate tech, fintech are really the three kind of sectors. Second vehicle, we just launched our fundraise for Fund 2. That will be a similar thesis, but a larger fund, doing larger check size, playing more of an anchor role. Web 3 will still be a pretty big, you know, layer within that, although not the exclusive focus. And then our third vehicle is our piloting vehicle. And that's a grant-based vehicle, and that's where we are essentially using grants to partner with different protocols, projects, and companies that are exploring innovative use cases of blockchain or climate tech in emerging markets. And the intention there is there's a lot of hype around, like, let's say, smart contracts and insurance for agriculture, but not a lot of evidence of that being deployed. And then not a lot of transparency on, like, what does this actually mean for the farmer, for the reinsurer, for the insurer, for the MFIs. So the intention there is, like, okay, let's, like, isolate some really interesting potential use cases that people are excited about. Diverse group of people, not just the blockchain crew, but, you know, on both sides of the equation. And, like, let's actually subsidize it, launch it, and see what happens. And if it is a, you know, impactful use case or not. So we've done about, I think, 12 of those around the world, and about two is a little bit of a shill. We'll do a request for proposals in about 2 weeks for another set of pilots. So yeah, more info on that soon.
Very cool. So I think one thing that I'd like to get zone, you know, kind of hone in on here is, you know, you mentioned, you know, the investments here are focused on building climate and financial resilience in the developing world for the most part. And I think that's super cool. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking. And then what I really wanted to click in on here is that you have you make some Web3 investments, but impact is a big part of the story, is the entire story of the fund very much in a lot of ways. So you don't have to name any names, but I'm curious to know how MZV kind of communicates this thesis to LPs, right? If you're listening to this, right, how do you tell them when you go, hey, we're investing for impact, and also occasionally we run into Web3 and blockchain protocols where we think, you know, and then bah, what do you say? I'm curious. Yeah.
No, absolutely. I mean, it depends on the LP, obviously. So for us, we firmly believe that climate change is, I mean, it's the existential threat for humanity, and it's kind of our opportunity and our, you know, for those who have power, who have money like ourselves, who command those things. Like when, you know, me and the other partner, Scott, and the team reflect on this, like, what else do we want to be doing is this, right? So it's the thing that we want to confront. I think we have to confront. But having worked in emerging markets our entire careers, it's also a huge opportunity. And we think that the venture capital funds and the builders and founders who are focused on reimagining what systems and economies and food systems look like in these markets, which have a proven ability and have, you know, a history of leapfrogging developed markets in many ways, they're going to be the next unicorns. They're going to be the next really expensive and interesting companies, if you will. And so we think there's a pretty strong commercial argument around this. I mean, we've already seen this. Some of the most exciting developments, say Parametric Insurance, are coming out of the global South, right? Because necessity is required that. And so if we're looking at the future of like parametric insurance products designed for climate, essentially, we're seeing companies coming out of the global South doing that, and that's where we're making our bets. We also, at the same time, believe that those are going to be incredibly impactful. So helping these economies, these households, individuals, regions to adapt to climate change, which is already affecting them, is really where we want to put our money. And it's where we think there's going to be a lot of impact at the same time. And so we think it's kind of a, like, you can, I don't want to say you can have your cake and eat it too. There's certainly trade-offs. I mean, for us, the way we are looking at it is we're going to have a constellation of investments. I mean, we're not laser focused on a particular sector. We're going to have a constellation of investments across different types of classes and geographies, which across that diversify risk, but at the same time, we think will create really interesting kind of mix of impact that could have a systems level change. And then B, we'll have a mix of, you know, commercial and more modest returns. And so in agriculture, you're not going to see 100x, 200x like you would in the crypto world or, you know, Silicon Valley. But, you know, when we are doing investments in the DeFi space and the ReFi space, we do think we can get some pretty healthy returns off that. And then FinTech will be somewhere, obviously, in the middle. And so across that, we think that would be pretty interesting for a lot of LPs.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point on two fronts, right? Like, I would just like to reiterate a lot of what you said around climate and financial resilience, not just resilience for the developing world, which in many ways, I think, you know, you don't have to agree with this or not, but we, in a lot of ways, we owe them this, right? When you look at stuff like the loss and damages fund and what have you, but on the other side of it, building climate and financial resilience there, in my opinion, can alleviate climate risks everywhere, right? Because the thing is, every portfolio, whether you know it or not, there is substantial carbon risk in your portfolio today, whether you're a venture capital firm, whether you're, you know, in public equities, maybe a hedge fund, what have you, all of you are exposed to it. And so, like, this just makes sense for you to be investing in the both the people and the products that hedge this risk, because you, in some ways, you will end up, depending on what you do, of course, not everything, but some of the things in there will actually be very transformative, like Parametric Insurance. You're doing it over there in, maybe you're doing it in Ghana, maybe you're doing it in the DRC, what have you, but the learnings from that and the products that come out of it will hedge risk globally, right? And that's like a global opportunity, right? And I think that's like a really keen insight.
100%. And, you know, on that note, like one of our companies, Cloud Street, which just rebranded to Floodbase, you know, they've exclusively focused on direct observation and prediction of flood risk in emerging economies, where like that, the data sets, the models, the tools we have are very limited to do that. So that's where they carve their niche out. And then, of course, working with insurers and reinsurers to design products around that in, say, Nigeria, Indonesia, India. But, you know, if we look at some of the biggest flood events that have happened recently, it's been, you know, southeast of the US and other places. And what we're seeing now is a lot of the reinsurer partners are like, well, wait a second. Yeah, we love what you're doing in sovereign insurance in Nigeria, let's say, or in Ghana. But actually, this product would work very well for us in Louisiana. Yeah, and totally. So we're seeing that
or
it
like
may
Miami.
Make total sense. Or Miami, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you hit on a key point. I mean, like, obviously, there's a justice angle to that. Some LPs would, you know, from an LP perspective, care about that or not. But in certain segments, I mean, it's just whether it's regulatory, consumer, or just existential, a lot of roads begin and end at those, you know, land stewards who've usually been at the short end of the stick. And so Starbucks knows, Mars knows, all these food and ag companies know that their continued existence largely depends on how they engage with small and medium holders in their supply chains. And because of regulatory pressure, consumer pressure, and climate change, they're having to figure out and probably more quickly adopt technologies, models, and partnerships that allow them to do that. And the carbon piece is a really interesting one we've narrowed in on because, I mean, fundamentally speaking, this is something that a lot of the global South has, is they're, you know, the last bastions of biodiversity, and they're the last bastions of land that are, you know, able to be put under regenerative practice. And carbon is something that we have right now. There's a market for it, however imperfect, that allows for that transfer of money to actually incentivize that economically. And so we do think there's a lot of things coming together really now and over the next decade that's going to allow these systems of land use, of supply chains, to really reinvent themselves and give a little bit more power and voice to those who've been, you know, kind of excluded and kind of recognize their value in this.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, like, just to drop... I must say this before I say the book, but where I learned a lot of this too came out of a Marxist history of Africa, how Europe underdeveloped Africa, Walter Rodney, right? It's a great read because basically it just gets into like, hey, what is the economic history of the last 500 years from a Marxist perspective? I'm not a Marxist, but I think it's an interesting read. The data is all there, right? And so, like, you know, you look at that and you begin to see like, the precedence for Cadbury, right? Like in the UK, it's not good. Right? Like how Cadbury came to be is not a great story. Right. And like then you begin to look at it and it's like, yes, we have definitely evolved from that. Right. Like you had back then, you had things like, they had this notion of something called a marketing board because, essentially the corporate law in the UK and France and all these other places was like, hey, look, yeah, you can own the plantations and all that, but you can't, you know, you got to make sure it comes through completely through the British supply chain or, you know, the French supply chain. And this is where the ingenuity of a lot of people on the ground in these places, you know, kind of came to be. So like, you know, these marketing boards would establish prices because they're basically cartels, right? And they're saying like, hey, cacao that originates from our colony is this price only, and the government, you know, backs it and all that. And then on the ground, you'd have people, you know, between like Gambia and Senegal and these other places going like, hey, what if we just, you know, actually we can get a better price if we mark this as a French chocolate, so let's get it over there, right? And so you have these interesting precedents that from colonialism that really bootstrap these markets. And so it's really interesting now to see, you know, hundred years later, half a century later, people coming out and going like, well, actually maybe we should just do land tenure properly so that we can actually attribute that and make sure that person gets paid and make sure they get paid a fair market rate, right? And because then like we address everything at once. We address their financial resilience, we address the climate risk, deforestation and desertification at the same time. And, you know, we actually find a way to remunerate them more and create a market that, you know, actually has liquidity for that. So it's interesting how we've come full circle. Right on some of stuff. We're like,
it's so fascinating. And I guess this is just like the path I've chosen. But I was talking to a friend about this who's got a big carbon project development firm in Indonesia. And it's just all, you know, behind the scenes, you have to know like who's gonna be the next president and all these things. And it's like, oh, that intrigue is just so much more interesting to me than, you know, running a company in Silicon Valley. Not to trash that, but I'm just like, I just love, you have to understand the systems of where they come from, the culture, like how slow things appear to go, the relationships. It's just, there's so many layers to it that are fascinating. And especially when we talk supply chains and value chains, I mean, like, and you touched on, you know, a part that's, I think is the crux to really one area of our thesis is just the land use. I mean, we know from COP, I think 15, I always confuse COP 15 or 16 in Montreal, but like when we look at the key drivers of biodiversity loss, you know, incentives and choices and how we're using land is far the top of that, right? Versus anything else. And our systems for how we recognize land tenure, all the subsidies, all the supply chain financing, all these different things of like how it drives different types of land use for non-regenerative practices or takes people like that's all at the core of it. And so I think that if we are to kind of reimagine, you know, alongside land stewards themselves, you know, people on the ground themselves, indigenous communities, and empower them to kind of take control over this system, there's just has to be a totally different way of like how we economically incentivize different types of land and give them the tools and opportunity to, yeah, make decisions, have dignity and agency. And so I think that's a great opportunity that in some ways Web3 can power and enable. But then there's a number of different Web2 companies and this, frankly, traditional food and ag actors, which, you know, again, because of these pressures I mentioned, I think are going to have to think about this and create more inclusive supply chains. And so there's a huge opportunity there at this point in time to kind of reimagine how this all works.
Yeah, that's, and actually that's a great way to sort of backtrack a little bit and talk about the impact in the MCV portfolio, right? So, you know, those who have not heard of impact investing or what have you, it's fairly straightforward. It's looking at social and environmental impacts of your investment in addition to returns, right? So it's not like at the cost of returns, which is something a lot of people hear when they hear impact investing, right? It's actually just saying, hey, along the way, while we're doing this, what are the other things that we are doing? What are the other things we can measure, make legible, and act against, right? So I'm curious to hear from your perspective, how does MCV think about impact and measuring it?
Yeah, I'd love to pull my colleague Lillian, who's our brain on this. But I, one thing I'll preface is that there's lots of different flavors of impact funds, right? There's some that are focused on, say, a justice angle where they want to drive capital to founders that are typically underrepresented. You know, we all know the stats around 1 or 2% of individuals, minorities and women are getting VC capital in the US. I don't know the stats in sub-Saharan Africa and other places, but they're not much better given the circumstances and you know, the equity and diversity of the different fund managers. But fundamentally, there's like that style of impact investing. Where we come in is we're very much thesis focused. We're user centric. So what is the impact of our investment on those end users, partners, and communities? Is it allowing them to increase their financial resilience to stresses and shocks? Is it allowing them to increase their income? Is it allowing them to increase their resilience to different types of climate, you know, issues that are befalling them? And so the way we look at impact is really from our roots is like founders, operators, and builders in these countries is we have a perspective of where we can make the most interesting commercial and impact investments. And there's, again, a paradigm and spectrum across that. And so we're trying to make investments across all of that. So if we look at like, let's say agriculture, we know kind of the problem set within that. And we know kind of the different types of investments that we think can really move the bar. Vis-a-vis other investors, vis-a-vis what Mercy Corps, a nonprofit, is doing. And so we try to be pretty surgical. And so, you know, within, say, like land use, we are making investments in companies that are doing land polygon and ag field data collection, because that's like the basis of like the ag stack and a lot of other things in carbon as well. We're making investments in companies that provide insurance that wrap around whatever agricultural activity they're doing. We're making investments in platforms that allow farmers to get better market insight, access to financing, access to better inputs, regenerative knowledge. So we're trying to invest around that cluster, right? And then provoke where we can partnerships within our portfolio or outside of it so that these things kind of interplay and then truly kind of raise the bar for that farmer. Because if you just deliver them insurance, that's great, but that's really only one small part of the problem they're facing. And so when we aggregate this, sometimes those stories get a little bit lost, right? We work across globally. We work across so many contexts. There's so many different externalities that face user groups. But generally speaking, we're kind of looking at, okay, what has been the change in the lives we're seeing on a company-by-company basis? Is it an increase in income? Is it some self-identified climate stress that they've faced and felt they've been able to bounce back from? We really look at it like on a company basis, and we try to aggregate, you know, overall how many people have been impacted in a way they would characterize themselves as positive across the entire portfolio. So I hope I answered your question. That's kind of how we look at it from like a very granular perspective to like a macro perspective.
Oh, no, I think you did. And also, what I'm doing here is cheating because we need to think about this too. So, you know, give me all your notes. No, I'm just kidding.
The last thing I want to emphasize too is like, again, because all of us on the team have built companies or founded companies in emerging markets, we've really taken an impact management approach whereby we want this not to be seen as just like, give us this data, it goes into a black box, we have to tell our LPs, or we just want to, you know, pontificate about how good we are or whatever it is. We really want to take approach of how can we help you to better understand you as a founder, your users or your partners that are in, you know, whatever model you're building. Building those customer feedback loops and data loops will allow you to iterate on your product or service, see if you're delivering value. And impact data is essentially that. We're just tapping into that, right? Like, what's that farmer's income today? And as a result of your product or service, is their income higher? If their income is 5 times higher, you're delivering a pretty freaking good product or service, and that's probably a very good investment. If farmers are dropping off and churning, then we should know why. And that probably shows whatever negative impacts or marginal impact you're having. And so a lot of the way we position this is like, this is core good, just product design, frankly speaking. And like, we just want to be experts at like how that syncs with kind of the systems level issue and helping some of our companies. I mean, this is not like our entrepreneurs are incredible. And like, so they already do this, but like, we're hopefully a thought partner alongside this or bringing in smarter people like IDEO than us to help on it. But we also want to bring the 30,000 foot perspective. Like, you know, with our ag companies, it's easy for them to get focused and they don't know what's out there. And so being able to say, well, hey, we see that you're having a lot of like climatic flooding issues. We've got a company that could maybe partner with you on that. Or there's 5 other companies out there. So like, how do we help our companies also plan 10 years down the road? Like, what's the food system going to look like in Kenya? We're here as thought partners around that and hopefully channel resources that can, you know, allow you to plan for that and plan for your farmers to eventually work around that as well.
I think it's a really important point to pull out, right? Is that like a lot of the time people are like, impact, lower returns, but it's like literally you're tying impact to specific product metrics here, right? So like if you're looking, you know, like the farmer example you're talking about, this would be a leading indicator of your churn, right? It wouldn't even be a lagging one. You'd literally say like, hey, something's going on here and you need to look into it. And you can begin to track the farmer income metrics as a leading thing for churn very easily. How much did this farmer make in the last 90 days? And that becomes like a North Star for your team, and you're actually developing something people want and need, and it's delivering the impact, right? That's pretty wild.
No, I don't want to delude anybody, right? I mean, it's always apples to apples, right? I mean, if you're used to investing in Facebook, Uber, et cetera, you're not going to find those returns in agriculture. Like, just to take an extreme example, right? So like, but if you're investing in ag, then okay, there's a whole spectrum of different types of companies. And if you're investing in ag tech, then yeah, I mean, I think that the best companies in ag tech are going to have that orientation. And one of our best ag tech founders, Irvan Colonas with Vasham and his first company, which we exited, and then he's started another company, AgriYaku. Like what they were tracking in their orientation in like in a very challenging market and business model design was like, you know, every part of that farmer journey from onboarding, who we even try to onboard as farmers to when did they deliver the inputs? How many days until they get the inputs? Did the farmer get the inputs on time so they can plant when they want to? Like they're tracking every little bit of that because they want to make sure that that farmer experience is flawless. Because if it's not, there's informal traders around them who will, you know, who will upend their service, who will give them cheaper rates. I mean, they're competing in a cutthroat market. And so that data is critical for them to understand if they're doing running a good business. And from an impact perspective, like if we can see all that, we can really see, wow, like to what degree is this really improving and delivering value to those farmers? And then from a macro perspective, how is this recreating different, you know, supply chains in these markets? And what's this mean when there's been big events coming through? And so, yeah, to me, it's all kind of interrelated. And I think if you're working in emerging markets, whether you call it impact or just product design or whatever it is, like these are the types of entrepreneurs and the orientation I think you need to have to like build really challenging business models in challenging contexts.
Yeah, so I think that's a great segue too. Then now that we're talking about business models and all that, it's a good segue into the thing that's radically disrupting business models by expanding stakeholder participation, right? So, talking about how you folks are thinking about Web3. So I think we may have already made some co-investments together, or they're in the works. I don't remember all of them. So if they come up, we'll make sure we throw a little disclosure out there. But I do want to ask you, looking at Web3 and really for us, right? Like, I mean, when I say us, I mean Cerulean, not the ownership economy. Really, we're thinking about this as, really the climate problem is in many ways a coordination and ownership problem, and that all ladders back to agency for us, right? So how do we actually maximize agency against something like this meta crisis that we find ourselves in? And so for us, that's why we look at open source software and blockchains, because we think that a lot of what's happening out there, between, at the nation state level, the multilateral agreement level, it some of these agreements are, not big enough to deliver the impact that they need, right? Like, then some major actors are either missing or they're not incentivized. And then honestly, like, when you go down to the nation state level, like, they're not, the nation state itself is not big enough to coordinate around these issues. And then but it's too big to really look at stuff like the stuff that's happening on the street outside my house, like maybe in like Raval, where there's a lot of migrants in Barcelona and have you, right? So it for us, then we're really thinking about these in a lot of space. There's this interstitial sort of space here where you have, you can have really hyper localist monetary systems that make sense of value and share it, for themselves on their own terms. And then on the other side, there's global coordination of like public goods and stuff like that. So kind of as grounding us in that, I wanted to ask you, how did MCV then come to Web3? Why blockchains? Why did you guys get involved in this mess?
So I think, I mean, the real impetus, as I think a lot of people's journey into this is, you meet somebody who's a little bit of a priest or a mom or something around this, right? So that first person on our team who got the infection, I could say, was Scott. And he, every time I ask him, he says he's been in Bitcoin slightly earlier. So originally he said 2014, but now it's kind of gone back, So I don't know really, but I want to say 2014. And I think where his story, which I'm going to butcher, was, we had some interns in Kenya back in early 2015 who needed to get paid. And this was, to some degree when we were not fully integrated with MercyCore's system. So MercyCore Finance won't get happy with this, I think. But anyway, they need to get paid. And, PayPal wasn't working better back then, and every other mechanism would have been super expensive. And so, yeah, sent them Bitcoin for their payments and said, wow, this is easy, simple and fast. And then number two, Kenyans were, at least the interns we were working with, who were very astute and forward-thinking and have been influenced by M-Pesa and digital finance for years, were using this. And so I think a light bulb went in his head and he said, wow, this could be the future. And he comes from, Lehman Brothers and Wall Street for a bit. So like he also had, I think, seen the moral hazards in that. So that was his journey, what got started and went down in the rabbit hole. I would say the big seminal moment for us is when, we started working with a number of different layer one protocols, and then different kind of DeFi actors back in, I want to say 2017, 2018. And a lot of them were kind of looking at us and saying, well, you guys have a really good fintech portfolio, great understanding of the space, and we really see traction with emerging markets users, but we're still struggling to figure out like what is really the potential. Like, how do we product design in these markets? How do we really accelerate local development communities around whatever protocols we have? And so that's where we started to see, okay, well, we have this expertise in kind of how we build financial products in emerging markets and these companies across a variety of different sectors. And we started being that, I'd say, integrator between Web2 and Web3. And so that forced us to some extent to think through, okay, well, there's a lot going on in this Web3 space, but where can we really be experts? Where do we think there's impact aligned with our thesis? What will our LPs allow us to do? Because, certainly we're in a very unique position where most of the people we engage with are not Web3 savvy. And so like what risk can we take? What matches our diligence profile and all that sort of stuff? And functionally, it came down to, I think, a few things. It's like, how do you democratize like asset ownership in all its forms and governance? I mean, it's one of the, I think, the wonderful promises of Web3 and something we subscribe to. Like, how do you give dignity and agency to all users and participants in these different systems. So that's number one, that's like really attractive, and there's different use cases around that. Two, how do you just solve, as we talked about at the top, like liquidity crunches? I mean, this is just, emerging markets have been, you know, for good reasons sometimes, but not always, seen as more high risk. But often it's just been tales of misunderstanding the borrowing capacity or the productive capacity to take on debt in some of these markets. And so we do think that there's just a huge potential role for DeFi and Web3 to play in, like how we democratize access to capital, but also the underwriting decision making for war capital flows. And then three, I think like when we look at just all the hurdles of how ownership is accrued and then assets are transacted, especially in emerging markets, there's a huge opportunity, whether it's carbon credits, whether it's land assets or fractionalizing all sorts of other assets. There's just so much there that blockchain and Web3 could power, which would be super fascinating and exciting. Yeah. And so I think those are the three main areas. And then, of course, in each of these sectors, I could go deeper, but I think that's the three things that have really attracted us about it.
Let's recount here, right? Yeah. So we have fractional ownership, which is the last one. We had like DeFi, liquidity, mm-hmm. loans, what have you. Remind me the first one.
First one was like ownership and governance over expanding, like actual.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. Gotcha. And this is a big one that, you know, I say this is like a white Caucasian American male fund manager in the US, but like, yeah. you know, I've always think it's kind of ridiculous, like how decisions are made. And we know this in the venture capital arena in particular, yes. but like, it's kind of ludicrous. And that's functionally speaking, if I want to dive into number one, is like when, you know, when Mike and Blake with Goldfinch pitched me back in, I don't know, 2018, and they're like, oh, we want to build this thing, which will, you know, essentially democratize how we make underwriting decisions and drive capital to emerging markets, startups doing great work. I was like, yeah, sign me up. This is like what I did with Kiva back in 2007, right? This is the next iteration. Awesome. Yeah. So on Goldfinch, when Mike and Blake first pitched me back in, I think, 2018, referred by our friends, Joe and Ideo Colab. When they pitched, they said, hey, we want to utilize DeFi or create a protocol that would simultaneously drive more liquidity to emerging markets, startups that are building really impactful products in emerging markets. And then two, democratize how these funding decisions get made, like the underwriting of it. To me, it was like, oh, this is exactly like the next iteration, the Web3 iteration of what Kiva was doing back in the 2000s, which I was working with. And so I was like, yeah, sign me up. And it took another year before I think Mercy Corps got comfortable in Web3 to see how that would fit in our thesis. That's a whole other journey I could describe another time. But yeah, I mean, to me, Goldfinch is like a quintessential in a DeFi space investment for us, where we, for years, many of our companies have struggled to raise debt to fuel their growth. There's more and more equity coming in these markets, but it's just not there. And I think Goldfinch aims to solve that. But what they're trying to do in the long run is, how do we use the wisdom that exists in these markets to generate pipeline of investable opportunities, and then B, democratize the underwriting and decision of where that money goes.
Yeah.
And like, it's just been amazing to me. Like one of my colleagues, Tofin, who we hired in, was participating in Goldfinch. I've met, when I've traveled to Mexico, communities of, you know, people who've put their money in Goldfinch, who are, you know, feeding into investment decisions. Like, you can see how this taps into that body of really intelligent people who've built products or are doing finance in these markets, who are contributing deals, who are contributing to the underwriting, and taps into a wisdom that, you know, frankly, a fund manager sitting in New York trying to place money in emerging markets, I mean, they could do a good job, but they're not gonna, you know, they're not in the long run. I bet on the crowd, right? So
yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really important insight, because basically, you know, this goes back to what you were talking about with why Web3, right? Because a lot of this stuff can be cross jurisdictional, and it can be instantly liquid, right? Because like, the thing is, just to zoom out a little bit, we did a previous episode with Ethan Buckman, the co-founder of Cosmos, and he cool. went really deep on collaborative finance, which is a concept that's kind of been coming out of academia that he had come across, where he was basically just trying to answer the question of like, how do we inject liquidity in the system to clear mutual obligations, like networks of mutual obligations? Because this really, I think, goes to the heart of what you're talking about, debt, right? And just, you know, in that episode, we were talking about, well, like, you know, if I owe Tim money and Tim owes someone else money and we have a closed loop, but that person owes me money, then that's a really easy obligation to clear, actually. Like, you can do the whole thing if it's equal, you can do parts of it if it's not, and everyone's clear, right? And this is I think people don't really get this, right? Is that this is one of the major challenges for developing economies and even developed economies, right? Like you have a small business, it has more than enough assets to cover its liabilities, but it can't cover its accounts payable with its accounts receivable. But if you were able to kind of make its network of obligations clear, you can then inject liquidity in the system and just close the loop, right? And so that's really what a lot of things like Goldfinch and PayHippo and these other things these services are trying to do, is that they're like, hey, there's actually more than enough collateral here now, like in the last 20 years, for us to actually securitize something and give you debt for it. Great, right? And that solves a major problem, right? Like, people are sitting here going like, why aren't developing markets, functioning markets, is that and the other? I'm like, I mean, where do you start, right? But this is one of the key pillars.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, I think that, you know, the fintech stack has evolved over the last 20 years, you know, with that first wave of like, Zoom and PayPal, and then moving into like 2010s, where you just started to have all these niche fintechs that are more consumer oriented, Stripe and their equivalents, like because you said PayHippo, now I'm gonna mess up the different names, but you know, all these different building kind of layers within Sub-Saharan Africa in particular. We're gonna focus on that, or PayU in Latin America. And now, and a lot of these had to build the full stack themselves. But now, given where we're at, you just have embedded fintech in these different modules that allow anybody who's starting a company to kind of pull what they need for, like, say, KYC. So it doesn't have to be you have to build everything yourself, but like, there's 1,000 different KYC providers. You can pull the KYC you need. You can pull in factoring if that's part of like whatever SME platform you're doing. It's all there. And that's where I think the interesting moment we're in when we talk about like the Web3, I don't know if we talk about the Web3 mullet, but DeFi mullet, ReFi mullet, or anything else, is like you have Web2 enabled startups in these markets who deeply, deeply understand their customers, SMEs, whatever they're interfacing with. And I think as Web3 develops tools, APIs, UI, UX, that that is relatable, like on this issue of liquidity, then you're going to start to see much more adoption. And, you know, I think one indicator of this is exactly like PayHippo. I mean, from the earliest days, PayHippo is like, of course we want to work with Goldfinch or any equivalents, right? I mean, I think those entrepreneurs get the value that they bring. Mm-hmm. And that might be the interim step before things are, you know, truly decentralized and users will directly interact on chain and so forth. But I think that's the moment we're in, is like these integrators, these interfaces between the two. And certainly in Africa, like when you go to conferences, it used to be a lot of like Web3 builders just only, and now you're seeing, you know, some of the biggest Web2 companies that have scaled significantly who are showing up and brokering those partnerships and trying to be like kind of that last interface.
Very cool. And I think that's a really good spot then to kind of dovetail into sort of our last topic here, which is this burgeoning regenerative finance space that we, you know, continues to be here, continues to grow, et cetera. Right. So I think it's a very early space, even for us. Like, we're, I kind of bristle when people call us the ReFi fund, but, you know, we've supported a lot of ReFi projects. For us, it's really about the impact at the end of the day. It's not necessarily having the, you know, tying our cart to the horse of ReFi. It's basically tying it to the horse of, in many ways, the three sort of things you were talking about. But for us, it's really very much about expanding ownership, about making sure that incentives are accounted for across that ownership chain. And then also just saying, hey, how do we actually build the tools necessary to make a lot of the inputs that we get for free from nature into the economy, you know, a thing that is legible, transactable, and shareable with a wider, much wider, you know, circle of people? Because as it kind of stands with the way that we extract from nature for inputs into the economy, a lot of that extraction comes from the global south, as you've seen, you know, from palm plantations, from cacao plantations, etc. It's productized and sold for a premium in the global north. And then, so, you know, we for us, it's very much a thing to say, like, in addition to the carbon economy and other things we talked about, the core issue for us is very much distributed ownership and coordination around some of these things. And so I'm curious to know, you know, what is your take on ReFi? Is there an MCV take on ReFi, or is it too early?
No, I mean we're super excited by the entire refi space and just participating in it. And again, we have multiple vehicles to engage, right? And so our I'd say our approach is and I depending on the audience, this comes across, especially if people come from kind of like a global medicine background, global health. But when I say like we pathologically collaborate, I truly mean it, right? So like there can be a lot of different ways where an equity investment doesn't make sense for us, right? Just it's too expensive, too early, not quite the match for our thesis, hard to measure the impact. There's a thousand reasons we don't do, an investment. We see like 2,000 deals a year and we do like 10 to 15. But because we exist within Mercy Corps and can support projects on a variety of fronts and just fundamentally want to see good stuff happen, I mean, that's our modus operandi, right? We are always eager to help projects along, especially in the refi space. And then with our piloting portfolio, that's where I think we've done a lot of our grants, because a lot of what's happening in refi is still, yeah, still really early. They're still building kind of protocol level. They still don't have really use cases in market. And that's usually a hard barrier for us to get around when we're actually making an investment. And then two, I mean, refi space is so new that we've had to kind of formulate a thesis around it, which slows down our deployment compared to other areas, right? So for us, I'd say like, we're excited about it. That first wave of refi, I don't know how long. I mean, we could say refi has been around for what, like 15 months in theory or 16. I mean, yeah, I
It
mean,
depends on who you ask, because I've had
exactly.
I've
Yeah,
gotten into
I
some
mean,
fights about this with
Regen's
people
been doing
who,
refi since 2017, I guess. But
yeah,
but
exactly, yeah.
generally speaking, like the movement as we know, it's kind of like the clean Badao is that moment in some ways, and that a lot of people choose. But
Yeah, that's right.
a lot of it was like experimentation, like money and talent and people flowing into it, which is exciting. A lot of like focus on carbon marketplaces and so forth. And now I think we're getting to like actual products going into market, a lot more for us, which is more of our comfort zone of like, okay, like how is this tangibly deliver value and is it meaningful value to different participants? And so I think we're starting to see that. We're also starting to see some of the projects come of age, like Senkin's big round, which is amazing. Regen Network doing all these amazing kind of experimentations and different types of credits. Like we're starting to see some like I think actual tangible progress in the space, and we're also seeing a diversification beyond just carbon, which is a nice kind of area
Yeah.
for everything to focus on. So we're excited about long term. I think that I do like that refi has become a home for what I would say are a lot of impactful types of builders that really merge environmental impact with other types of impacts in the global south. I think like as a community, we're gonna have to work through what that means. Like, I mean, is Goldfinch considered refi? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, is like I think we're gonna have to figure out like what refi really means. But I think the principles behind it and the inclusivity behind it's great, and it's exactly the place like functionally we want to put money, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, like, as you're developing your thesis here, I'd be curious to know a bit more. Like, what do you see as the gaps, right? Like, what gaps can refi fill? Because I look at this and I think one of the ones which I am now being a lot more vocal about because the time is right is that I think that Web3 tools, machine learning tools, digital MRV, IoT, a lot of stuff is there now for people to build fully on-chain originated supply, right? So like there's been a serious, crisis of confidence in the voluntary card markets, and I actually think that will come to the global compliance markets as well, because a lot of the players in the compliance markets are just kind of moving stuff from column A to column B. Yes, it's an $850 billion market, but when it comes when your Oracle is the government jurisdiction you're in, I'm interested to see where the impact is, right? So I'm curious, where do you folks see refi really filling a gap?
Yeah, I mean, I think long term, their direct origination of I mean, I think we have to be honest, carbon is the credit, it's the mechanism we have now. I mean, I think we all know it's imperfect in terms of not capturing biodiversity and other indicators and co-benefits, and there's a whole debate about commoditizing it and so forth, I'm trying to get into, but carbon markets exist for all their imperfections. There's real money flowing through it. And so our position on the carbon markets as we tasseled around and developed a thesis around it, and it's all on our website if you want to dive in more, is these markets have to work for the land stewards. If they do not, nothing else matters. And I think we see this in Brazil. We're seeing this in Indonesia. in these markets with the most biodiversity and landmass that could be put under management. If it becomes a capitalist land grab that excludes indigenous communities and land stewards, it's short-lived because the governments or the people themselves are going to have an uprising. And that land grab's already happening. I mean, I've been saying this for like 8 months. I mean, finance is flowing like crazy to acquire land now that the carbon markets are at a place where it's attractive, right?
Yep.
Compared to other things you can do with the land. So I think anything that makes origination possible, I mean, wonderful state is that I could go to a farmer, not me, but, you know, like one of our ag platforms, go to a farmer and say, they can do this now, by the way, like, okay, you can plant maize, you can plant soy, whatever it is, like, here's what it looks like, here are the protocols, here are the inputs. I mean, you can imagine another scenario. It's, well, actually, if you do this agroforestry, here's the subsidy from carbon sequestration you get in the credits. Here's the productivity you could get from harvesting that sustainably. Here's the other crops you could do around that. Like, that level of information should be available to anybody in the world to make informed decisions and hopefully incentivize them towards regenerative practices. And that's slowly coming. And that all should be on chain, frankly, too. It's going to take time. And I think that it's going to take a lot of partnerships. But that's what we're, frankly, super excited to invest in and also to do pilots on. I mean, this embedded carbon within other ag platforms that are interfacing with farming is a huge opportunity. Huge
absolutely
opportunity.
You have my attention, sir. And after the pod, I'll drop a little something for you actually. You mentioned that a lot of this stuff should be on chain. Which stuff do you think should be on chain? What do you think should be on chain?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's moving carbon markets is easy to me. It's just so logical. I mean, I think almost everybody I talk to agrees that that's where the market's going to go. So I'll kind of put that to the side. I still question whether supply chain data, and we've made investments in this. I still don't know if the time is right for supply chain data to be on chain, whether it needs to be. Like, is there really a some sort of delta there commercially? Are regulators really going to clamp down in the way they say they will? I think it should be, but I don't see necessarily. I mean, we've been talking about this for years since I think Goldman Sachs or somebody did a report in this like 2007 or no, not that early, like 2012. I don't think it's there yet. Unfortunately. But you know, one day, probably driven by regulatory pressure, it will. I think that real world assets, whether like we talked about before, all sorts of different assets related to, you know, contracts, related to land, to housing, physical, all those things, like being on chain solves a lot of kind of liquidity and other issues that we see in these markets. And we're already starting to see that in real estate, which is like the easy one, frankly.
That's a really good point I wanted to harp on, because there's this great, I don't remember who did this, but you know, we'll have to invite you back on in like 6 months, because I want to do an entire episode where we just talk about like Web3 tools for land tenure and registries and all that, because, you know, there was this great little own like Twitter clip that went viral around Packy McCormick getting owned by some guy who asked him like, give me a Web3 use case. And then he talks about like real estate and NFTs and fractional ownership, and he just owns himself because it's clear that he didn't really like think about it. Right. Like, and so I think like it'd be great to get into a lot of what, you know, you folks have seen at MCV. Like, you know, you've mentioned this in passing. I happen to know who you're talking to, so I'll just throw it out there, right? Like Meridia.land, which we'll put in the show notes, is a super cool project. It's not on chain. And honestly, I don't really necessarily think it should be, like, you know, right now there are definitely arguments for it, but the idea just being that, hey, if we're going to, you know, from a regulatory perspective, enforce the fact that if you source a particular commodity for a product that you sell in the EU, you're going to have to actually have an impact claim against it. They don't even need to see the whole data. They just need to see that the claim that you made and how you substantiate it, right? Is basically how I understand the law that they're putting together for this, right? And so Meridia plugs into that chain and says, hey, here is what the land registry data says. This polygon belongs to that person and it ends here, and this is where the thing came from, right? And so like that kind of thing, if you wanted to make it publicly verifiable, there are arguments for it, and if you didn't, there are also arguments for that, right? So
and I think that, like, I would love to jam on just like the use cases as it relates to land, and then invite in, I mean, there's such a rich body of people who have just fought for land rights for you know 100 years, right? And who come out on very different sides of the equation of like where blockchain has use or not. I think, yeah, so anyway, there's a lot of really smart people who'd have really fun debate around this that I know, who come out on all sides of it, right?
Yeah.
But I think functionally what you're getting at with Meridia is to me the crux of it. And this is why it works. It works really well for the carbon markets, because with Web3 is like, and this is a very layman's non-technical person explaining this. So the way I kind of look at it is like, we want this pipe, and there's going to be many different people feeding data into that. And there's going to be different plumbers, if you will, who are kind of cross-validating whether or not anything's been tampered with or any of the claims being made against that data is actually accurate, right? And you're incentivizing people to poke as many holes as possible so that the end product is better and that there's transparency and trust, and that anybody who comes at the very end can just run algorithms to verify the whole thing. You can do that. I mean, in carbon markets, it's easy. It's going to come way sooner than I think we expected, because it has to, and there's a lot of money in it. Land tenure is a really hard one, because we have to sort out, I'm trying not to use expletive language on here, but there's just so much.
You always can.
There's so much shit we got to dig out of. I mean, when you look at like 82% of the world's, or sorry, 72% of the world's population lives on land they don't have security over, psychological or formal. And a lot of what people have been pushed out, displaced. I mean, it's just it. And like every time there's some sort of conflict, we have to figure out, some human being to some extent has to figure out who, you know, between two hard cases, who really rightfully owns this.
Yeah.
And so just putting things on chain, imperfect as they are, could lock in, you know, something that's very imperfect or even horrible and wrong. So it's a very challenging one. But the data, just the core data, is hugely important. And that is where I think we can start, is like, how do we, in a lot of these economies which have fragmented or non-existing data, how do we just create that data trail? There's always values attached, but how do we just figure out what's that polyvalent, what's a land steward, what trees are they growing, what assets do they have, all that sort of stuff. And once we start to create that data stack, and then cross-reference that, you know, in a data union model or something else, like there's all sorts of magic that can happen. And I think Meridia is at like one end of that, like that initial data, but then you have all sorts of other suppliers, remote sensing, you have all sorts of other companies that are collecting data. Like, we have to build that from the beginning, and ideally give that ownership of that data and permission to the land steward themselves and allow them to capture the value from that. And so that's, again, from our perspective, where like Web3 intersects is like, If these pieces all connect, and whether Meridia is a Web3 company or not, like, they're fulfilling a really hugely important promise, and they'll plug into Web3 for sure. I mean, I think in the carbon markets, absolutely. And then in other areas they can. I mean, there's all sorts of other companies too, that I think the Web3 community can look to as oracles, as partners, as, you know, kind of commercial B2B channels. I mean, I think this is where the next 2 years goes in ReFi, frankly, is just like this merging between these worlds.
Yeah, and I think what you said about land is really important, because there are nightmare scenarios, you know, dystopian scenarios here for land tenure, especially where if you treat the current, you know, what must not happen is that a lot of ownership is tied up in social and cultural dimensions, right? It's not just what the land registry says, right? So there's a lot of disentangling, as you, I'm sure you're well aware of, that must happen before you even do something like that. And for treating the existing tenure as, you know, correct and true, and then building NFTs, it could be a dystopian scenario where you just reify the 72% figure you dropped eternally, right? Like, now it can't be undone. And so it's a super careful thing. And I think you're 100% right that you approach that, you know, extremely carefully. But, you know, maybe you just start with a data trail, right? It's not even ownership. It's just like, what does the data say, right? And then and it's not an enforceable, you know, entity. It's just, what is the actual, you know, history of this? It's a really interesting idea. Just to, you know, dovetail on it for a second, then we'll wrap up, is, you know, we just bought a house here in Barcelona. And I'll tell you, you know, people are like, oh, developed country, I wonder, you know, it must have been easy peasy. Incorrect, right? Like, there has been a land registry here for probably 1,000 years. I don't know how long they were at land registry.
The Spanish cadastro system is interesting. Yeah. They've imposed it on Latin America, so I'm familiar.
Exactly, right? So like cadastral mapping the world over, like when you're looking at America, easy peasy. It's a couple hundred years old. Who cares? Move on. Like, it's, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, colonialism, etc., whatever. But like the here, you know, you're talking about you'll go to a house and it'll be like, great. So what ended up happening is that so this place is actually zoned 60% commercial and 40% residential, but the people bought it and they waited 6 years before they made any changes to tell anybody because it, it passed the statute of limitations and now it's a house. But the bank won't finance, well, bank will only finance 40% of it, right? And like stuff like this happens all the time,
Jeez,
right?
that's
So
crazy.
yeah, in Spain for sure it happens all. I
Yeah.
can tell you, just shopping in the Barcelona area, we looked at 40 houses and we were like, maybe something like 20% of them had issues like this. So you're just like, what? Like,
Yeah.
what century am I living in?
No, and this is where sometimes blockchain is kind of like hammer searching for a nail. But as you understand the problem set, like putting ownership claims on chain, yeah, complexities. But how, and I'm sure you experienced this buying your house, I don't know Spain, but like my experience in the US, years back, the number of different entities that have to interact to essentially process a
Oh
mortgage, and then
my
it is
God.
insane. And in Colombia, I think it's 15 different institutions, and you have to have everything
Oh
notarized,
my
all these things.
God.
That is a great use for blockchain. The government of Colombia is, I think, working with Ripple right now to automate essentially the transaction side.
Wow, very
100%,
cool.
go for it. I mean, that doesn't necessarily have to embed what the land map looks like now. And Colombia's got a lot of issues, like
Yeah.
any country that's had a lot of conflict. So they're not going to touch that side, as I understand it. But at least for new transactions, how do we make that cheaper, more transparent? How do we kind of take the power away from those kings who, the
Yeah.
notaries, frankly speaking, who
Yeah.
kind of control it, slow it down, and drive up the price? And then the intermediaries who kind of facilitate the system for better or worse. That's
Right.
a great use case. And so
Yeah, yeah.
I think sometimes when we look at like these big systems issues in the global south, there's something there, but it's a staging of like where do we kind of go first? And then, given that money is a little bit more scarce in the Web3 world now, for better or worse, I think that's going to force some harder decisions, which I think is frankly good. Like, where does the value proposition felt most, so that we don't, accidentally, create a lot of negative impact by putting
Yeah.
money in something that could do something wrong. So anyway, I think the land piece is fascinating to me, and yeah, happy to do a big jam on that, because to me that's the crux of pretty much everything we're doing. And how do we, like, last thing I'll say is, like, there's a company, Cadasta, a nonprofit actually, and that's their tries modus operandi is like, we the way we understand land tenure is having a formal land certificate makes
Yeah.
no sense. I mean, and there have to be other ways to create data trails, whether it's through telco data, through community engagement or participatory mapping. Like, there's a thousand different ways that we can create a stream that essentially gives somebody like between 50 to 80% tenure security. And then maybe you can go to the government and get that recognized in a different type of land system. And they're doing great work there. And again, they're a great conduit for whoever wants to do work on in blockchain and land tenure piece, because these guys know how to do it at scale. They have some of the best experts in the world on it. So again, I think there's a willingness from parties like Cadastre and others who are just saying, like, you know what, we see as technical experts, we see the value of where blockchain could be and where they're excited to engage. So again, I'm just excited for these worlds to start coming together more, and we're here to fund that, frankly, right?
Yeah, and I think this is a really good point for just blockchain in general to harp on is that these are not, land is not some permissionless system. Like there's a whole bunch of entanglement from social and cultural truths that are there as well, right? Like so you can't just be like, oh, well, the government wrote this thing on there and so it's true. It's like, yeah, you could do that, but that's like the most violent, brutish way to do it,
Yeah,
basically,
yeah,
right? So like
yeah.
having that's why I really like this I did you say it did you say it was Cadastra? The
Cadasta, yeah, Cadasta.
Cadastra, right? So like, that's like a really interesting way to do it because you're just doing the transaction side of it or whatever, right? Like once it's ready for the thing to be put in the system, which says that working backwards from that, a lot of these social truths of ownership have been addressed. The
Yeah.
intersubjective realities have been addressed, and this is what a number of parties agrees on. And now you can say, is that repeatable? Should it be repeatable before you make it a system-wide truth, right? And that's interesting, right?
Yeah. And even for like, I mean, again, we could have a whole episode on this, but like, in cases of displacement, there's an organization, I forget the name of, that, in Syria, when a lot of people left, like, how do you help them build their data history of what they occupied, knowing that someday they're going to go back to Aleppo and somebody probably is going to be there, and there's going to be a conflict, right? And so how do you use like telco data that's readily available, other types of documentation that might not be a land certificate because they probably didn't have time to take that with them if they even had it in the first place. And so there's a lot there in the data history that people are working on and crunching away at, which is fascinating. And then, you know, again, what CADASTA has been doing in like informal settlements in Colombia, parts of Africa and India. And again, just like, how do we broker between two really hard complexities? Who owns that land legally? And then those who've maybe been there for generations, and how do we kind of give both sides the opportunity to come together, present evidence of their case, and, you know, essentially find some amicable way to sort it out. And so anyway, I think that to me, like this land use case, how we incentivize it, how we bring truth to it, how we create data around it, how we drive different economic incentives like the carbon markets and other types of credits. That's a huge piece of like where we're excited in the refi space moving forward. And again, where we want to try to, on especially on our grant side and pilot side, just like how do we precipitate partnerships or at least proof of concept that, you know, kind of get at whether this future reality is possible.
Yeah. Man, that's awesome. I literally liked where we ended. I could talk about land forever. Just as this perspective I come to it from as well. But you'll cover that on a future pod, man. So I think, you know, last thing before we fade out here is to tell everyone where they can follow you on the internet. Where can they find Tim and MCV's work?
Yeah, absolutely. You can check out our website at www.mercycorpventures.vc, corpse with an S. And then you can follow me at Tim Rann, TimRann on Twitter. Yeah, my DMs are always open, always excited to hang out with people. We're typically on the road for a lot of emerging markets like venture capital, convenings as well. So FLEA in Mexico, ATS, Africa Tech Summit, we'll be at ETH Denver. So always come up and say hello. We're excited to chat with people in real life as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tim. And if you all enjoyed this, remember to like and subscribe and for more of the ownership economy. Thanks again, Tim.
Yeah, thank you. Really, really a pleasure.